Here we go. We're recording. Okay. And we're going to let some people in because you have a lot of very eager people in the waiting room. I think Catherine snuck in first. Could have been Cecilia. I'm not sure. I lost track. There's so many of them. They're flooding into the doorway. So we're going to keep letting some more people in. And as I'm doing that, I want to welcome everybody to the Friday webinar here at USDLA. I'll give you just a couple of quick announcements before I turn things over to Bernardo because he is the star of the show today, or maybe his little friend is the star of the show today. I'm not sure. So we'll have to, I'll let you all make that decision. But just a couple of quick things just to get this show on the road. And also just to let those remaining people sneak in the door, because a lot of people come in right at the top of the hour. I know they're if they're like Bernardo and I, they're just running from meeting to meeting and they're like, okay, which meeting am I in? So there we are. All right. So I think I let everybody in temporarily. We'll look back at that in a moment. So again, welcome to the USDLA Friday webinar series. We're glad to have you back here again today. If this is not your first time, you're welcome back. And if it is your first time, great. I'm so glad you found your way here. And I hope this is not your last time with us. So a couple of quick things. As you know, you are here today to learn from the amazing, the astounding, the incredible. I don't have enough adjectives to describe Bernardo. He's a dear friend, and I'm so thankful that he had some time today to sneak us in between his other calls and things. But he will be talking to you in just a second. But I do want to let you know that coming up next week, we have a return visitor. Joe Evanick will be here. He'll be talking about AI. I know some of you seem to be interested in that. I don't know. It's apparently a thing. I don't know. Bernardo, have you heard of this AI thing? I don't know. It seems to be all the rage. I don't know. Anyway, so yes, Joe will be with us next week. And then the following week will be the beginning of August. I don't know how that worked, but anyway, somehow it's almost August. And we are returning to our previous pattern that we used to do a long time ago, where the first Monday of each month, we're going to be featuring speakers from one of our chapters. We have other chapters not on this map, but the first couple I just kind of teased in there. So Friday, August 2nd, you'll get to meet the founder of the Delmarva chapter and meet some of her colleagues and, stay tuned. You'll learn more about what they're going to talk about on that Friday. But that'll be a monthly feature, so you can tune in. So wherever you are in the country, there's either a chapter for you or there's a chapter nearby, because all of the chapters are very open. If you happen to live in a neighboring state or something like that, hey, you can play along with them. So learn more about that. Also, you might know, you might not know. I don't know. We have a YouTube channel, which is usdla.tv, very easy to get to. Many of our past webinars are featured there. So if you miss something and you want to go back and you want to learn about it, for example, one of our recent ones, again, another one on AI. This one was very popular because they were talking about a large-scale survey that they did and telling you about all the results when they were speaking to administrators and trustees and students at various institutions. So kind of cool way to get your hands on some of the findings from the research that they did. So you might want to check that one out. And there's, again, a whole bunch of other ones up there as well. Also, get out your calendars and mark some dates down, save some dates. We have Public Policy Day coming up in September. That's Wednesday, the 25th. A little different, not a Friday, it's on a Wednesday. And then in January, we'll be coming up with this year, that'll be that year's Public Policy Week. So that'll be several sessions each day for the entire week, and keep watch as we start announcing who those speakers will be in the coming days and weeks. Also, you'll be seeing announcements about National Distance Learning Week in November. Obviously, every November, USDLA was one of the founding members of National Distance Learning Week. You may or may not know that. But that's November 4th through the 8th. And again, a whole week of free programming. This year, we're going to be doing some different things. There may or may not be some gamification involved. There may or may not be somebody who's in the background, and it's not even me, doing some design on some pervasive games and things like that. So stay tuned. There'll be more about that coming up. In fact, you can be part of the design of some of that. So you'll learn more about that in the coming weeks. All right, and then finally, I have to always say a huge thank you to all of our amazing sponsors, because without them, I wouldn't be able to stand here and do this for free for you. And so that's a good thing. that I get to do this. So we have at the platinum level, even though his icon's a little bit too small and I need him to send me a new one, we had John Chin with Engaging Virtual Meetings. He is the platinum sponsor this year. He was the video producer at our on-site conference, in fact. So if you are a member, you can go and watch all the videos that he recorded there, as well as any of the virtual webinar pieces that we did in the days leading up to and after the on-site conference. We also have our gold sponsors and silver sponsors on screen. If you work with any of these people, please go give them a huge thank you for helping to make events like this possible. If you have not heard of them, go check them out because they do cool stuff. And all of our people, whether it's hardware, software, services, whatever, all things that are needed if we're going to support our distance learners wherever they are. And then finally, we have a whole host of bronze sponsors and our exhibitors and friends. And again, likewise, if you see names you're not familiar with, please go check them out because they're all doing all sorts of interesting different things and they would love to talk to you. I know at the conference, many of them wanted to get feedback. They want to hear, what do you want to know? What do you want to see in your products? And maybe you have a competitor's product, but you can say, hey, this product over here does this cool thing. How come yours doesn't do that? I always love when people kind of challenge them with things like that. That makes life kind of interesting, I guess. Anyway, that's all of my announcements for today. So I can now turn things over to our webinar speaker. And again, for those of you who came in after I said my hellos to him, Bernardo Latif is here and he is, I cannot say enough great words about him. I've known him for a number of years now and just, you're going to have a great, I'm going to say is you're going to have a great time in this session. So I'm going to shut up. I'm just going to be over here checking out the chat. And I'll jump in if anybody needs any help with anything or if they have a burning question. Okay, does that work for you, Bernardo?
Works for me. Thank you very much.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for being here today. And thank you all of you for being here to play along with us.
All right. Perfect. So let's take it on. And there you go. I'm hopeful that you can see my screen. Yay. All right. So hello, everybody. I know that the title for the webinar is How to Create Engaging Adventures, but I love to rephrase that to Cult Monsters, Friends, and Punches. And before I move forward, just a little bit, a quick thing about me is that I designed a software called Blue Rabbit in the past years. In 2014, I started using it to gamify my classes and to actually run everything like it would be a game. And for the past years, we've been playing with it, and we have successfully engaged with over 13,000 students, and things are looking up. We start with a brand new 8,000 students in the upcoming weeks. So if you want to give it a chance, and if you want to try it out, just let us know, and you're more than welcome to do so. And our specialty is on player engagement for we like to call it for learning environments, but we have done it for conferences, we have done it for just training events, and we have done it for long-term engagement with semesters or year-long courses along the way. And throughout these years, we have developed this idea. This is a concept that a friend of mine shared with me. So these three beautiful elements work together beautifully in pretty much any gamified solution that I have, any gaming successful gamified solution that either I have seen or I have built. And the reason why it works topples directly into all of our psychology and the deepest things of our minds. But it is consistent, it is very effective, and it's very easy to understand once we have the elements. And how we can group them, how we can shuffle these three things together is what makes it a beautiful salad of engagement. So without further ado, I'm going to start over. Yeah, I'm going to start with it if that's okay with you. If you have, by the way, if you have any questions at any point, shoot them through the chat and I will make sure that I do not pay attention to any of them ever, and you will not be able to clear your minds on that. Okay. So Valerie, you can help me out with any question that comes up in the chat. If you guys want to interrupt, just unmute yourselves and just say, hey, what you're saying is wrong. And I will definitely dismiss you immediately and keep on going. Real quickly, what is this formula about Cool Monsters, Friends, and Punches, and how do they create engaging experiences? So when we look back to, I learned this about 21 years ago, maybe 22 years ago, when I was learning how to play Dungeons and Dragons. And a lot of what I have done is based on the principles of Dungeons and Dragons, because they have been doing engagement with players for the past 50 years. They just celebrated 50 years, which is outstanding. And they do know how to do it. Regardless of how complex the rules might be, the basic principle under at the end of the rules, and it's printed in at the beginning of the manuals, is everybody should be having fun. If you're not having fun, stop following the rules and just make sure that people have fun. And they are just providing you with a framework that allows you to calculate mathematically certain things to make the adventures more or less engaging. But the real secrets behind it are what I'm going to share with you in this formula. So this friend of mine, my very first dungeon master, he told me every successful cartoon or video game or a game follows these three things, which is cool monsters, friends, and punches. And it's pretty much having, if you and your friends are fighting cool monsters, then it's going to sell. If you are a cool monster and are fighting some other cool monsters and there are friends between them and they're all of this, it's going to sell. If you hire cool monsters to fight on your behalf, or somebody's hiring cool monsters and you have to defend against them, and the punch is pretty much everything that happens between the monster and the friends. But if you have any of those combinations, and by any of those combinations, I mean think outside the box, where you can have clusters of monsters and friends fighting each other, and then they fight each other, and then everybody's playing around all together. It's what makes the engagement happen. And if you don't believe this is successful, just take a look at Pokemon, which is one of the most successful stories, games, and video games in history. You can take a look at Dungeons and Dragons, which is one of the most successful games and video games in history. You can take a look at Fast and the Furious, which is a very successful franchise. I think that there's no other movie franchise that has 10 movies, one right after the other. And if I'm correct, they might have actually 11, because there's a couple of them that are not exactly on the same part of the Toretto family. So I can name you pretty much any successful entertainment franchise out there, and they follow through the same rules. All of them have cool monsters, all of them have friends, and all of them have punches. So before I move forward with it, let's take out your pen and paper and let's talk about a couple of definitions real quickly. The very first one is the difference between a problem and a puzzle. And I don't know if anybody has knows that. And I'm gonna open up the chat. And thanks, Jennifer, for playing Dungeons and Dragons. I love that, and you still do it. So if anybody knows what the difference between a problem and a puzzle is, and if you do, type it down in the chat. I'm gonna give you a couple of seconds. If you have any idea what this might be, I can. Oh, by the way, I come with sound effects integrated. So do 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 do. Okay.
And I happen to know
So
he's an easy grader, so even if you put an answer that's not quite right, like that's okay too. You're in a safe space. It's okay. You can answer anyway.
you can answer whatever you want. It doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. If you're wrong, I'm gonna be sure that you never forget about it. Basically what the definition between a problem and a puzzle is, a puzzle, you have all the pieces, and all you have to do is mix them around and order them, or make sure that you find the right position for each of those pieces. And a problem is a puzzle that's missing a piece. So when you have a problem, you need to solve it with an element from the outside. And your job when you're gamifying something, or when you're designing something for other users, is to help them turn their problems into puzzles. If you have you have a puzzle, sorry, if you have a problem, the players cannot progress. So that's one thing, because they don't have the pieces. And that's the beauty of it. Sometimes the piece they're missing is a skill or a learning element. So understanding what the pieces what pieces make a puzzle is what sometimes make it a little harder. But you have to think outside of the traditional elements. It's not that you're giving them physically wooden pieces to solve the issue, is that sometimes it's an idea, a perception, a course they should have taken, a meeting they must have gone to, maybe notes that they should have taken. So that's what makes the difference between a problem and a puzzle. So it's important to know those two. So you do not create problems for your players. You put them in positions where they have to solve puzzles. That's going to start creating a lot of more engagement. Another definition I like to understand is what love actually is and what the opposite of love is. So basically love, and I love this definition from the Buddhism, is love is wishing for someone else's happiness. That's it. So we don't go into any additional over explanation of it. We will go into what happiness is in a second, but love is wishing for somebody else's happiness. So what would the opposite be? Because anybody who has been in a relationship with anybody else, and I'm not talking about a romantic relationship, I'm talking about any relationship, knows that love and hate are not opposite feelings. And if you don't believe that, it's very simple. You can love someone who has done something very bad. You can wish for their happiness, but you can hate something that they have done. That does not remove the love from the equation. That does not mean that you wish for them to be unhappy. You wish for them to be happy regardless of something hateful they did. So love and hate are not opposites. So what's the opposite from love? And I am very consciously using Comic Sans as a font. Thanks, Jennifer. Exactly, indifference. But I'm using Comic Sans because it's the most indifferent font in the planet. And when you feel nothing against something, then you cannot act against it. It's absolute indifference means I'm not, my entire brain has deleted that from existence. And if you go into the never-ending story, it's what it would be the nothingness, right? That is that it's like when you look at something, you feel like you're going blind. It's not like you're seeing a hole. A hole is something. But if you look at something and you're blind about it, it's like that. That's what I mean by that. So it means the lack of emotion. That would be the opposite from it. And then we go into happiness. What does happiness is? Anybody. I know I'm getting philosophical and this should be right? This should not be a philosophical element, but what would the definition for happiness be?
But with each one of these, more people have responded.
Yes.
So you're creating engagement. That's what you promised in the title.
Here I am. So happiness is the ability that I love that Ram Gopal, I don't know what, if that's your name or just a nickname, but it says something that brings you joy. It's almost there. The definition for happiness is the ability to enjoy the present. So I wish for somebody else's happiness means that I wish for them to be able to enjoy the present. I want you to stop feeling anxious. Stop worrying about the past. Stop worrying about the future. I want you to know and enjoy that you're right now, you're alive, you're feeling everything, you're here. And you can do things, right? So what would be the opposite? And you're not allowed to say unhappiness, right? So what we do know is that the opposite feeling of happiness is depression, which is inability to feel or to enjoy the present. When you're depressed, you're absolutely worried about everything else. You are not focused on this moment. And actually, there are a lot of exercises that you can do to get yourself out of very deep depression by focusing on the present. It's what a lot of people in the autism spectrum, they would do by grounding themselves. Find five things, four things, three things, two things, one thing, and then you start doing that, and then you kind of get your body back, your mindset back into the present, and then you can start walking away from it. And it's also sorry, a chemical imbalance in the brain, and I know there's a clinical level of it, and I'm not a neurologist or psychologist or psychiatrist, and I'm trying to redefine things, but we know that the opposite from happiness is depression because it disables your ability to feel the present, right? Describe love again. The love is the wishing for somebody else's happiness. That is love. Okay? Now, why am I talking about love, happiness, and puzzles and problems when we're supposed to be talking about engagement and cool monsters, friends, and punches? Well, because Those things are what makes monsters cool, right? In the terms of gamification, in terms of creating engagement for your audience, a cool monster is the problem that somebody has to solve. And if that problem does not create love or creates hap make somebody feel happy that they're engaging with the problem, or they don't understand, and that thing is a huge problem, and I don't have the pieces to solve, and I feel depressed about it because I have this overwhelming feeling of that I won't be able to accomplish it, and it keeps on bombarding me with more and more and more elements. I'm going to end up becoming blind against it, and I'm just going to go and act like that problem does not exist, and I will not engage with it. So you have to make sure that your monsters become puzzles for the players. Your monsters make your players happy, and your players love the problem at any level. That's the one thing that you have to do. I want you to think for a second, what would happen if you could potentially create any learning problem or learning disengagement look like this, and visualize that this monster here is going to take your kid away, or they're going to take your heart away, or they're going to take your ability to debate or something away from you, and you have to fight against it. And it's literally trying to visualize that this heavy, furry, ugly gangster type monster, with this beautiful blue leather jacket that apparently it's his own skin, is going to take everything away from you, and you have to fight against this. And if you manage to help your players visualize this is what they have to solve, then the engagement's going to happen very differently. And I mean, I'm using AI to create a monster and look cool and everything. Unfortunately, thanks to these new AI tools, we can democratize design and production fairly quickly and have some very high quality images that will help us support visually the images that we want them to convey. But the concept behind it, it's what's going to drive the players into fighting against it. Now, some of the most successful games out there are text-based games. I don't know if anybody knows about one game that I love a lot. It's called Dope Wars, where you're supposed to be a drug dealer and you have to you go to different cities, sorry, different parts of the city in New York, and you have to sell things. There's absolutely not one single image in that game. And it was built for Palm. So I'm talking about the Stone Age Drug Wars. There you go. in your graphing calculator in high school. Yes, you did. I'm talking about a very, this is a Stone Age level of engagement. But we would play type games from very, very way back. And the engagement is not on the graphics. The engagement was that the cool monster that you had to fight was the dealer who at the beginning sold you loaned you the money, and you had 25 days to pay before they broke your legs, right? And you're not a good guy. At the same time, we can talk about one of the most Choose Your Own Adventures. It's a fantastic example. I had like 25 of those things. But imagine when you are trying to play one of the most successful video games in history is Grand Theft Auto. And Grand Theft Auto 5 specifically, and with the, apparently someday will come up the Grand Theft Auto 6, but it's a crime simulator. You're not playing the good guy. And it's one of the most successful video games in history. It's about what you're fighting for and how that those stories become. So your cool monster will define the entire narrative of your story. So this is a way I define it in terms of theory. And in this case, you can define your cool monster as challenges or obstacles that must be solved, right? Or, very important, support devices. Why am I doing this? Because if you play Pokemon, the cool monsters are fighting with you against other cool monsters, and they are your support device, right? You cannot fight against Pokemon without a Pokemon, because then you would be fried by Charizard in a flame, right? If you don't have a very cool magic sword or magic shield that would protect you from the acid breath of a black dragon in Dungeons and Dragons, you would die immediately. So you have to have all these different types of support devices that are part of the cool monster's environment. When we talk about the Fast and the Furious franchise, what are the cool monsters? Who can tell me that? Anyone? And I'm talking about the villains. The villains are monsters, yes, and they are bad guys. And but what are the cool monsters there? Because when I extrapolate this concept, the bad guys are friends, are a group of friends, because it's not just one bad guy, right? They have a lot of friends, or mercenaries, or people they hire, and they pretend to be their friends. But you have a lot of friends on the one side, and you have friends on the other side. What are they using to fight? Your cool monsters are the cars. So you can even use the cars as cool monsters. You can use the horses. You can use the pen that they use to write in. If you have not seen the anime, please avoid the Netflix movie Death Note. Avoid the Netflix movie. But if you go and you watch the anime for Death Note, one of the most incredible cool monsters is the notebook. It is incredible how they use that as an element to drive the narrative, and how that tool becomes an incredibly powerful element in the story. And the way they start using it, and how he hides pages, and how those pages work, and what you can do with it, that's what's mind-blowing about it. And it's one of the most successful animes in history. So learning from that, you can start thinking that your cool monsters do not necessarily need to look like that guy. They could become a pen that's magical, or it could be I don't know, a compass or something like that. So we have to learn to use those cool monsters very, very effectively. Now, when we come into talking about them as challenges, so when they look at challenges, you can call them bosses, minions, traps, or curses. Each of those have different applications. They have different traits. A trap is something that it's a challenge that a player falls into, and when they don't necessarily have the skill to solve. A minion, I'm sorry, a minion would be a challenge that only requires one skill to be defeated. A boss fight would be something that requires more skills than what the player currently has. If your player has 5 skills, the boss would be someone or something that has 8 or 7 skills or 9 skills, right? And a curse would be taking away one of the player's skills. When you get the players in these types of positions, then you put them into a puzzle position, and you say, hey, you have this, you have that. You put them into a problem position. You're missing one of the things, and you have to get what you're missing on a specific way, and you're providing them a path for progression. You're telling them, to defeat that monster, you need 3 more things you don't have. Here are the minions that will train you to learn those 3 additional skills. Or here are the 2 traps, or here's the curse that you have to beat or break. And once you break the curse, you will get your elements back, and then you will be able to defeat the monster. See it, because I know that I'm talking about something very explicit in terms of gamification, in terms of production, and a lot of fantasy, and a lot of graphically appealing elements. But when we take it away from all of that and we understand the concept behind each of them, it becomes very clear how you can use this in a learning environment. Because you can have very hard tests they have to check. Sorry. You have to finish a really, really hard test in the next 3 months, and they know all the skills they are missing. And then you throw them mini quizzes or mini challenges that target those specific skills that they are lacking. So they are fighting against the minions. The job of the minions on any story is to train the player to reach the level on which they can defeat the big boss. That's the job of the minion. And that can be any minuscule challenge that has 1 skill, that the player doesn't. When we try to learn five skills at the same time, our brain goes m too much. You do not learn 18 skills at the same time. You learn one. So a way of understanding this is I can put the players to fight against minions, one minion, when they don't have that skill, but I cannot put them to fight against a boss when they don't have three or more skills that they're missing. So trying to fix it that way. The three in the bottom, minions, traps, and curses, are one skill they have to learn to overcome. And the boss is a combination of those skills. When you talk about support devices, they can be pets, helpers, or gadgets. So Batman has the coolest monsters in this, right, under his belt. And if you don't have the skill to use a gadget, or let's say that you want to climb a wall, but climbing a wall is very hard if it's not, physically built for climbing. But maybe you have a gadget that you will throw something up, a rope, and then you can climb through the wall. So the gadget is supposed to provide you with kind of like raising your skill to a point where you can use it. But what should be driving the level of the player or how good a player is not the gadgets they have available, but how they use them. In gamification, we use in Blue Rabbit, sorry, we use a technique where when you want to purchase an item in the item shop, you must have the right level and the right amount of coins. We use two different metrics to make sure that you can purchase the item. Because if you have not reached, let's say, level 10, there is no point for you to use a book that only people who are level 10 or higher will take advantage from. So the gadgets should match the level of the friends and the players that are using it. At the same time, it's like it's a Chinese principle, don't use cannon to kill mosquito, right? If you give a very low level player a very powerful sword, then they will kill the monsters at the beginning so easily that it becomes boring. It actually be, if something is too easy, it becomes boring. And I cannot stress this phrase enough. Maybe you want to put it somewhere. Easy does not equal engagement. Easy and engagement are two very different things. What drives engagement is that a journey is conquerable, not that it's easy. It's actually the opposite. If I feel the journey is easy, I'm going to be like, I can do it on my sleep. I will not even do it. But if I know that people would rather be challenged than bored. Thanks for that quote from Jane. The second you challenge them and they know they can overcome the challenge, they go through it. And that actually has a psychological concept, which is called self-efficacy. The self-efficacy is our ability to feel that we are able to complete a challenge. And it actually is more important. High self-efficacy than motivation. High motivation does not equal you completing something, right? The higher your motivation, it's a good thing, but motivation runs for a short period of time, unless you have high self-efficacy. So your self-efficacy, let's say, it would determine how long your motivation will last. Someone who is this has been studied with cancer with patients with cancer and their treatments. Those who believe that they can actually complete their treatments, complete it. But the motivation of all of them is their life. So trust me when I tell you they are motivated to do the treatment. But why do so many fail to complete it? Because they don't think they will be able to complete it. They think that at some point it's not going to be used. There's no use for it. There's nothing to do it. When it's been proven that 80% of people who stick to the treatment enter remission. 80%. It's a very high number, but it matches with the self-efficacy. So we have to understand that we have to let the player know they can, and they have to feel they can, which is the number one thing that why we have this disengagement crisis, both in the workplace and in the learning environments, because they don't think that it matters. They think that it's gonna fall off, and then it doesn't matter what we do. We're not the goal. Right. Anyhow, so does anybody know that joke? Who's on first? If you haven't seen that, watch that video. You're going to love it. Who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, some third. It's one of those things that have made me laugh so much. But who's on first? Who are your friends? And the friends are the characters that interact with the monster, right? So you can have two different types of friends. On one end, you can have PCs, which are the player characters. It's pretty much you and I when we are playing, not when we're designing. When we're designing, we're not player characters, right? The player characters are your audience, and you have to make sure that they have access to different monsters and different abilities and different attributes and different skills and different things, right? While the non-player characters have a very specific job, which is guide the players towards the right direction. Right. So you have to let them know, okay, so go north. And then you go north. In our I shared in the LinkedIn a little teaser with our loop, our engagement loop that we use in Blue Rabbit, which is how you prompt your players, and then you have to process the action, then you have to find a consequence for the player, and then you have to change the world, then you provide feedback, and then you go back. So you have the entire loop constantly. But to prompt the players, most of the time you're going to need a non-player character. This non-player character does not have to be someone physically. It does not necessarily mean it is a person who stands up, a cartoon, a little monster, like a cool monster that's telling you, hey, it can be a note on a bottle. It can be a message on the screen saying, hey, you just got here in time. But what I want to kind of like transfer to you is that it has to feel like someone is talking to you. We love to talk to others, and trust me, even if you are the most in how do you say if you don't want to talk to anybody else, right? If you want to be left alone in the home, at some point you reach out to some friends online, or you'd reach to some of your other not so outgoing friends. You will always try to find somebody else because we have our brains built for it. We do not release specific neuromodulators in our brain, which allows us to feel better about it, about our entire minds, and our state of mind depends completely on human relationships. And I am going to throw a ball here and assume that everybody heard something about a pandemic in 2020. I'm not sure if anybody happened have that, but some of us who might be looking like, oh, we're super outgoing, and I like to talk to everybody else, and even though it looks like I'm an extrovert, I'm not. I love to be left alone and playing video games. I would love to be in a hole for a week. For us, the pandemic wasn't that hard. And even then, we had a lot of depression, a lot of issues, and a lot of problems. And it's because that lack of contact is heavy. So remember this, your NPCs and the prompting of your user and the direction has to feel like it comes from someone. If it does not feel like it's coming from someone and it's just an instruction booklet, you are killing your engagement heavily, right? The number one thing you don't want, and there's this guy I love. It's called Martin Lindstrom, and he's pretty much, I would say he could be easily appointed the inventor of neuromarketing, because he was the first one to analyze through fMRI how people would react to different advertisements. And he started a podcast a couple of months ago. And it's about the Ministry of Common Sense, which is his latest book. And he says, why do we believe that there's billions of stars in the sky, and you have the scientists telling us how, I don't know, the vacuum tubes for communication works and all these little things, and we believe all those things. But when we see a sign that says wet paint, we try to touch the it says wet paint, and we're still trying to touch the paint to see if it's wet. So we don't like kind of like the sign just to tell us things. We love it when it's someone telling us a story. You can watch those episodes. Look for Martin Lindstrom podcast, and you will find it. The first episode with the space commander, Chris Hadfield. You will love it. You're going to love the episode. It touched a lot of points around it. So don't forget about it, right? Your users are your player characters, and everything else you use to guide your players should be your non-player character. And guess what? They could be monsters, right? They could be cool devices that you're using to drive the engagement of your players, right? And lastly, what are punches and why not hugs? Yeah, because I said so. So, if we talk about punches, the punches are pretty much the interaction. And it feels much better when you say, hey, I punch a big monster rather than I just went and tried to hug it. Especially if it's a dragon that's trying to kill you, you don't want to hug the dragon. Maybe the dragon needs a hug, but we won't know that until the dragon is calmed down and stopped trying to eat the entire town. And at the same time, we can easily change the punch for absolutely anything that means interaction between the player and the monster. And that's pretty much it. It's the action between the friend and the monster. So whether a friend is commanding the monster to attack a town and destroy the town of necromancers who were trying to control the world, that is the punch. I am telling the monster something. So the action I ask the monster to do, that's my punch. And then the monster punches other punches and everywhere. It's the general term. Why not action? Because action is a term I didn't want to use in my book. So anyhow, I think that it sounds much better when you say punches. But it's a principle. You get people to fight on the same field and it automatically gets them to kind of like think that they have to defend something or they have to fight for something. It gives them a much higher sense of purpose than just trying to feel like we have to send an email, right? Or answer a quiz. And I know that, for example, when we were doing the trying to transform the it was a cybersecurity and compliance training for a bank in South Africa. And the way they were playing it originally and the way a lot of companies do it is that they throw out the compliance training and they have to complete a questionnaire every 3 months, right? And 95% of the people would complete the questionnaire the deadline was coming up because the system would lock out their user in the office until they complete the quiz. And you want to know what was the number one discussion through those days? What's the answer to this and to that question? People were not learning anything. They were trying to get over an obstacle that made no sense and that was getting in the way of them being able to do their job. But they did not care at all about the learning. They would ask somebody else for the answers. And who was providing them with the answers? The compliance team. Because they wanted to have a high percentage of achievement. So you have the system is rigged and everybody's cheating, but at the same time, it doesn't matter because then there's no goal. So we were trying to design an entire strategy around it. And we created cool monsters that you would have to defeat. And we would have everybody to become a friend. And they were supposed to be training an AI, and the AI was actually the players answering questions from each other. So all we did, we create some anonymity feeling, right? I feel like I am not the one being answered, and I am doing, I am answering something for someone, but when I get the prompt, it's actually the AI asking me something. So I have to answer the AI, but I am actually replying to somebody else who made a question, but I don't know who I'm answering to. I think that I am populating a database for it. And that was very well received. It was a very different approach for it. It only lasts for a couple of months, but anyhow, it's a bigger idea. Is this done as an individual quest or can
one and see if the
Oh, sorry. Yes. Thanks, Sherry. Is this done as an individual quest, or can groups be assembled as players' learners go through this journey? So you can notice that I said friends, plural. All right. And I'm going to get into this for a second, and let me see if my, oh no, that's not last. So I don't know if we have enough time. If we do, I will jump into that other slide. I have to search for it. But one of the ways of organizing your players is in parties, in guilds, or in different types. There are several different terms for it that you can use to organize to go through this journey. And team players is by, sorry, multiplayer is one of the most beautiful game mechanics that you can think about it. But here's the thing. If you're fighting a boss, right? By the definition, the boss will have more skills than the player. So what if the job of the player is find the missing skills in other players? So you limit the amount of your abilities. The player can only have X amount of abilities, X amount of skills, X amount, let's say 5. But the big boss monster has 20 skills to be defeated. So there's no way I can do it alone. So I have to find others that have different abilities. And in role-playing games and video games, we call this making a party, where you have a tank, which is someone who has a specific ability to fight, like the paladin, who has a big shield and a big sword, and they can take punches. And then you have DPS, which is damage per second. And then you have people in the back throwing spells or throwing arrows or throwing other things. And then you have a healer, which is someone who makes sure the tank doesn't die, because if the tank dies, everybody dies. And that's a four-player party. That's a very, very standard number. You can get into an alliance, which is six parties altogether. And it's pretty much the same setting, but six times. And then you have 20 people, sorry, 24 people fighting against a huge, huge monster, which has an insane number of abilities, and they have spells that affect everybody else. So you can do this with multiple players, as long as you define very clearly what the skill set of each player is, what the limits of their abilities are or capabilities as users are. For example, you can say something like, okay, so the typewriter can only type 1,000 words a day. And then you have the sender can only send 20 letters a day. And then you have the collector, which is they can only collect 12 letters per day. So what's the point of having someone who can send 20 and then you have 12? And then you start playing with these variables on how I can have the player go but not throw 20 cards at the same time, and they have to be smaller and shorter. And then you start playing with these numbers and you define how the abilities match each other. And it's really fun when you start playing with these games. It's really, really, really engaging. How or even can these elements that seem violence-oriented be balanced with non-violence play? 100%, I understand what you're talking about. I love violence. No, you just get away from the violent component. Instead of calling it punch, you find the thing that they will use to interact with the monster. So let's think for a second that the monster is someone in marketing, right? And this person in marketing is they are being very I don't know, they object against everything. They don't have budget for anything. They constantly say that your ideas are wrong. I don't know. You name the amount of objections, or the way I called it is annoyances that they have. You know, this is a very annoying monster that they will come back at you and say blah 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 blah. No to everything, right? So the skills that you provide the players are oriented to better communication. And then you say, okay, so how do we fight this type of objection or this other type of objection? And then you train different players in different abilities based on the knowledge you have from that monster. You say, you know, I know that this person will object against this, 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 and that, but they will not object against this, this, and that. They're looking for something like this. We already have this information. And then you design your adventure around those elements. It does not have to be that, but it has to offer an obstruction. It's not that it has to be something violent, but it has to feel like it's a challenge to overcome. The reason why I choose or I use so many violent elements is because in video game design, in game design, most of the time you build for that, because it has to have some sort of, even the easy fun of it, which you can talk to Nicola Sarr about it. Even if it's a game like Tilt World, which is a little chameleon that's trying to save the world, there's no punches or anything, but there's a lot of, you know, that a lot of sound that makes you feel like plack, pluck, plack, everything is happening in that way. It allows for this easy concept that something is interacting with the other user. Roman Rakowitz, which is one of my partners, he always say that humans are haptic. And that's the reason why you have in your phone the vibration every time you type a key now, because it gives you the feeling that you're doing something. If you remove that vibration, unless you're looking at the screen perfectly, you might think that nothing happened. So that's why I use the punches approach, because you want to feel like somebody's actually acting, like it feels like back, like what I did sound, something sounded on the sound on the other side of the equation. And I can quote 100 different nonviolent ways of doing it, like the example I gave you on the on this bank where they have to type in and answer a question. They're not violently doing anything. The cool monster is the AI, but in reality is other players who are interacting with each other. We have another example where we were making an interaction tree. Well, it's what I call a garden, networking garden, where you would have to talk to other players and find people who were struggling with different things. So you would post a question and you would expect somebody else from the architecture team to be able to answer it. And you would be prompted to actively answer those things as the missions would come up. And then you would earn certain tokens and use those tokens to praise other players. You would not be getting rewards and very important things. I have not talked at all about providing your players with rewards because that's a different conversation. And I don't like rewards. I like resources. It's a very different place where we can start discussing about it. But the players do not need to earn or to win a trophy after everything they do. They just need to feel like they're progressing. They just need to feel like, oh, we killed the dragon. What happens now? Oh, look, the door is open. Oh, now look at the lair actually leads to an interdimensional door, or it just opens up the way out of the mountain. You know, we were living inside a valley and we were trapped by this dragon. There's a very, I'm gonna call it underground anime called Gurren Lagann. It's not a very good thing, right? It's not a very good anime. But one of the principles is that people have to live underground. And the secret behind they have it, they are supposed to be oppressed by some forces that are keeping them underground. But the reality is that there's a higher level of entity that if at some point detects that there's more than 1 million people living in the surface of the planet, they have to destroy the planet because they don't want it to become a virus. So they are actually protecting the people, but the people don't know and they're kept in the dark. So it's kind of using these principles in a way where they play around into solving the problem. Why do I have to live underground? Why do I have to be felt like I'm a cockroach from these entities from the different planets? Right? I think that we're about 6 minutes away from closing. I do want to throw out, we're running a couple of master classes around this. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Between Roman and I have been designing this workshop. We just ran our first edition a couple of weeks ago. And if you're interested, please reach out. That's our phone number, or you can go to the website. But we actually have it's four more sessions of this, of much more depth on the specifics. Roman talks a lot about the non, sorry, I go through the explicit part of it, and she goes more into the implicit side of gamification. How do we actually provide with some concepts that are not necessarily into the cartoonish, anime-ish world of production. And I do the other side where I can provide you with tools and all the elements that will help us design an experience that engages with the people in a very different perspective. Because everybody's expecting text and LMS and all of that. But not a lot of people are expecting that suddenly the monster that comes up, it's this hairy, furry, leather, blue leather wearing monster that's going to attack or affect us on our environments. And they're trying to train us into a different into a different lesson on cybersecurity. That's the unexpected, and it actually helps so much with breaking the ice. And when people don't expect it, it changes completely their engagement with the content. And that's what you're looking for. You want them to stop thinking straightforward. You want them to change the challenge into, oh, look at that. Now it turns out that if I am not good at compliance, I can get my wife involved in a very bad business by working in this company. And I didn't know that. So it's kind of like really getting people into feeling something much more exciting. And it's really not so hard. All we need to do is think a little bit around outside the box, read a couple of stories, go back to when we were kids and pull those memories back and use them against our learners because it is always effective. And that's for me. That's it for me.
Well, thank you. And I just want to pop in. I know some of you have to log off at the top of the hour, and I want to respect everybody's time. So if you do need to log off, I thank you so much for being here today. And I always thank my future viewers because we get a lot of people that watch the video in the future. So I always say hi to them too.
Thank you.
But I'm going to stay on for a few minutes if Bernardo can hang out. If anybody has any last minute questions, I'll stop the recording in a moment. But I never kick people off the lawn. I'm not that kind of person. So if you have questions for him or you just have questions for me about
Thanks, April.
USDLA stuff or anything like that. Otherwise, I'm gonna stop the recording, but I'm not kicking you out, so you don't have to leave. All right. So thank you again, everybody, for attending today. And thank you so much, Bernardo, because people's minds were like over here. They're like, please tell me there was a recording because, and there is. That's why there is a recording and it's ending right now. Okay.
Yay.
There we go.
Okay.
I want to stop the recording.